Quite a backward-looking point of view, and a rigid conservatism which opposed new ideas and changes.
Certainly there has been a tendency to be backward-looking in a way and to a degree that Confucius himself was not at all. But regarding the attitude of Confucians toward imperial authoritarianism, it's pretty hard to generalize about a group that's been so large and so various. Confucianism has never been organized, never, and has never had an officially recognized leader. I suspect that if we examined the records of those men that Confucians in general would say were the best Confucians in recent centuries, we'd find a large proportion who conspicuously opposed imperial despotism. And it's certainly a historical fact that Confucian principles were often invoked against oppression and on behalf of the rights of the people. At the same time, though, if we look at the great mass of mere office holders who made up the great majority of those who called themselves Confucian, we'd certainly find that most of them were as subservient to authority as such men usually are everywhere.
Well, Hurley, how did this distortion of Confucius' original teachings come about?
Well, Earl, that's a long and complicated story. Probably the most important single reason for the distortion is that although Confucius wanted to let men think for themselves, most people don't want to. They find it easier to follow a leader or to believe in a book that's supposed to have unquestionable authority. That's why the so-called Confucian classics began to be declared authoritative soon after Confucius' death, although it's certain he would have opposed it. This follow-the-leader attitude can easily be used by unscrupulous persons for their own purposes, and that's why the Confucian doctrine was twisted to make it appear to support imperial despotism. The first emperor who used it in this way was on the throne almost exactly 2,000 years ago. He made an elaborate pretense of being Confucian, but it's perfectly clear that, in fact, he was a totalitarian despot who despised Confucianism. He put large numbers of so-called Confucian scholars on the government payroll and tried to promote the doctrine that Confucianism preached blind allegiance to the emperor. This is a flat contradiction of the genuine Confucian view that a man must follow his own conscience. The real Confucians would not accept his dictation, but the bread-and-butter motive was pretty strong. And a great many others accepted the emperor's doctrine for the sake of the good jobs they could get.
Still, if the ideas of Confucius opposing these things were on the record, that must have provided a certain obstacle to this kind of distortion.
It did, but they got around it in two ways. In the first place, as you know, ancient Chinese is rather cryptic and leaves a good deal of room for interpretation. When some of the commentators got through interpreting what Confucius had said, Confucius himself wouldn't have recognized it. In the second place, very soon after Confucius' death, people began changing and adding to what he was supposed to have said in order to use his authority to support their own ideas. They even added to the most reliable book we have, the Analects, some things that Confucius couldn't possibly have said. Not all scholars agree exactly on what changes and additions were made, but all scholars agree that there were such changes. This was, of course, a very insidious kind of propaganda, and contributed greatly to the distortion of the original teachings of Confucius. Nevertheless, you can't fool all of the people all the time, and down through the centuries, there have been many scholars in China and elsewhere who have doubted or even denied that Confucius said many of the things that he's supposed to have said.
Even though there has been considerable distortion of the original ideas of Confucius, I think we both agree that Confucianism has carried down to the present time certain beliefs and practices which are a fundamental value in enduring
work. Yes, let me give you a very simple example of the way the idea that you must respect human personality shows up today. That's what's behind the practice of bargaining when you buy something. An American may offer a Chinese shopkeeper a dollar for something and be refused. Then another man comes along, offers 80 cents, the shopkeeper asks him a dollar, and they strike a bargain for 90 cents. The American gets hopping mad and says the Chinese is dishonest, but he misses the whole point. In China, you have to recognize the personality of the other fellow. Every transaction must strike a reasonable compromise between your view and his. I've tested that out. In a curio shop in Peking, I once offered a dollar for a piece of carved ivory. It was a fair price, and we both knew it. But the merchant said, add a little something, add anything. But I told him, you see, when I looked at this thing, I said to myself, it's worth 90 cents. But I don't want to be unreasonable, so I'll pay a dollar. So you see, I told him, in my mind, I've already added something. The old man was delighted. He said, sold, sold. I had recognized his personality, and he was more pleased than if I'd paid him $2.
Well, Hurley, that's a good concrete illustration of Confucian individualism. But how do Confucian ideas work out in the philosophy of government?
I think that Westerners, in looking at the traditional Chinese government, have paid too much attention to the emperor. They forget that in Confucian theory, the function of the emperor is much like that of the king of England, who reigns but does not rule. The Confucian philosophy of government might be stated in capsule form in this way. 1. The proper aim of government is the welfare and happiness of the whole people. 2. This aim can be achieved only when the state is administered by those most capable of government. 3. Capacity to govern has no necessary connection with birth or wealth or position. It depends entirely on character and knowledge. 4. Character and knowledge are produced by proper education. 5. In order that the best talent may become available, education should be widely diffused. 6. It then follows that the government should be administered by those men, chosen from the whole population, who prove themselves to have profited most by the proper kind of education.
Now, Creel, we've been talking about the importance of Confucianism in China. Let's consider its influence outside of China. Those who have studied the Far East are, of course, aware that it has had a great influence in countries bordering on China, such as Annam, Korea, and Japan. Although in the latter case, it was considerably changed in certain respects in the process of being adapted to the Japanese system. It also has had considerable more influence in the West, I believe, than is generally realized. Do you agree with this?
Yes, Pritchard, I do. There's no doubt that Confucian ideas, when they were reported back to Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries by the Jesuit missionaries, aroused great interest and certainly had some influence. Voltaire credited Confucius with bringing about the happiest period and the one most worthy of respect if there has ever been on this earth. The thing that impressed Europeans especially was the remarkable amount of relative equality that existed in China. This made a good deal of impression in Europe in the period just before the French Revolution, when opposition to the principles of hereditary aristocracy was gathering its strength there.
Creel, while I'm willing to admit that Confucianism may have had some influence on the development of early ideas in the West, democratic ideas, that is, I'm inclined to think that it encouraged other tendencies even more. Proponents of enlightened despotism thought they found a good deal of support for their ideas in the Chinese system, and often pointed to it as an example and model.
Of course, there was that side of the picture, too. Men who wanted to prove the case for enlightened despotism naturally looked for support wherever they could get it. And as we've already discussed, that element had been introduced into Confucianism. But let's look at what is going on in China today.
All right, let's do that. But let's keep in mind that the name of Confucius has had such force down through the centuries that reformers and despots alike have almost always tried to cloak their actions in the mantle of Confucius. Within the last 50 years, Sun Yat-sen, the father of the Republic and the founder of the Nationalist Party, certainly found much in the teachings of Confucius and traditional Confucianism which he wished to retain.
In fact, one of his close friends has said that Sun Yat-sen considered himself to be the modern successor of the Confucian school. Sun Yat-sen himself once said that China anticipated Europe and America by developing a democratic philosophy thousands of years
yes,
ago.
Yes, and even more recently, the Japanese in Manchukuo and North China tried to bolster their puppet governments with the idea that they were revivals of the traditional Confucian state, which the Republic had been breaking down. Now then, since the Confucian tradition is still such a living thing in China, it is bound to have some effect upon the course of developments under the communist regime. Let's consider various elements of that tradition, which will support and others which will oppose the communists.
Well, certainly the tradition of Spartan Confucian idealism is a factor that works in favor of the communists. Confucius said the right sort of man must be prepared even to lay down his life in doing his duty. There can be no doubt that the Chinese communist troops have fought in this spirit. Confucius also said that to see what is right and not do it is cowardice. And all the reports we get indicate that the communists are almost fanatical in their determination to prevent corruption among their membership. This naturally gains for them the admiration of the traditional Confucian for incorruptibility.
That's quite true. But on the other hand, if the communists ever soften up in this respect, the same thing will work against them, won't it? In other words, it's a double-edged sword. There's another double-edged sword of this sort in the Confucian tradition. That is the right of revolution. Traditionally, it has been accepted that when a government becomes corrupt, tyrannical, and ceases to render service to the people, it has lost the mandate of heaven and can properly be overthrown. Now, in one sense, the communists can use this to justify their revolution. But on the other hand, If in the process of carrying out their aims and objectives, they tax too heavily, push people around too obviously, and attack existing practices and ideas too much, they run the risk that the people will consider that they are violating the mandate of heaven and will revolt.
What else do you see in Confucianism the communists can use that may favor them?
Well, I think that the idea of obedience to authority will be of considerable help to them. I know, Creel, that you don't consider slavish submission to authority as typical of the best Confucian tradition. And with this, I certainly agree. But nevertheless, I do think there is enough of the tradition of following the leadership of the central government left to be of considerable help to the communists, so long as they seem to be giving honest and forceful leadership. However, there are certain other aspects of Confucianism which can't by any stretch of the imagination be twisted to the support of the communists. Their family system, for example, it emphasizes duty to the family as coming before duty to the state. This will be a hard nut for them to crack.
Yes, and all reports seem to agree that the communists consider the Chinese family system the greatest force against which they have to work. They're said to be working against it on a number of fronts, compelling the breaking up of communal family lands to abolish its economic basis, and using various techniques, such as youth organizations, to gain the loyalty of the children for the state rather than the family. Only recently I've heard it reported from two sources that little children are being taught to repeat, "I do not love my mama. I do not love my papa. I only love my government." The Chinese family was important long before Confucius lived, and in overcoming its influence, the communists certainly have a job on their hands.
Another thing which I think will cause the communists considerable difficulty as time goes on is the Confucian emphasis on the importance and dignity of the individual. This stands in direct opposition to the communist notion that the state or society is far more important than the individual, and that whenever necessary, the individual must be sacrificed to the collective interest.
That puts the finger on the crucial point. The Chinese are a nation of individuals. Can the communists change them permanently? That's the great question.
We are agreed, then, that the teachings of Confucius are by no means a dead letter in China today. We both think that while some aspects of Confucianism may favor the Chinese communists, its total effect is to influence the Chinese in the direction of individualism and democracy. On Tuesday of this week, President Truman made a speech in San Francisco in which he announced that the United States desires a partnership of peace with the peoples of Asia and acknowledged that their older civilizations have much to teach us. He also said that in this time of crisis, we ask the people of the Far East to understand us as we try to understand them. In this search for understanding, Creel, it is surely true that Confucius is a figure who cannot be neglected.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's unusual program on Confucius and present-day China were Hurley G. Creel, a noted authority on Confucius and expert on early Chinese literature and institutions, and Earl H. Pritchard, editor of the Far Eastern Quarterly and historian of modern China, both of the University of Chicago. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable on Confucius and present-day China contains the full text of the discussion and special selections from the writings of Confucius. Be sure to write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of today's pamphlet. Single copies are 10 cents in coin. A full year's subscription to the pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's pamphlet, which reprints from the writings of Confucius. Today's program originated in the Mitchell Tower studios of the University of Chicago. The Roundtable is directed by George E. Probst and is a public service presentation of NBC. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.